about school, and they enthusiastically tell me. I'm no fool. They are getting older, and soon they won't tear around the corner so fast, but I'm okay with that. Some might wonder whether I feel a pang not having a family of my own yet, or missing being an uncle for your kids. We would have made great uncles for each other's kids, Leo. Ellie starts to shoo them off me. Okay, girls, that's enough. Uncle Knapp has to do something in the workshop with Daddy.
What does he have to do?
Kelsey asks. Some work stuff, Bob says to her.
Leah, what kind of work stuff?
Kelsey, is it police work stuff, Uncle Knapp?
Leah,
are you catching bad guys?
Nothing that dramatic, I say. And then I wonder whether they know the word dramatic. And then I don't like saying that, since nothing dramatic may be a lie. So I add, I just need to watch this tape.
Ooh, can we watch?
Leah asks. Ellie rescues me from that. You certainly cannot. Go set the table. They do very little moaning before heading off to do their chore. Bob and I head toward the workshop in the garage. The sign above the door reads Bob's Workshop. The sign is carved in wood, and every letter is a different color. As you might expect, you could film handyman how-to videos in Bob's workshop. The tools are hung in size order, equidistant from one another. Lumber and piping are stored in perfect pyramids against the back wall. Fluorescent fixtures hang from the ceiling. Plastic bins, all properly labeled, hold nails, screws, fasteners, connectors. The floor is snapped together rubber modules. All the colors in the room are neutral and soothing. There is no dirt, no sawdust, nothing to dispel the relative calm of the place. I can't hammer a nail, but I see why Bob loves being in here. The camera sitting on the workbench is an exact match, a Canon PV-1, and I wonder whether it is indeed your old one. Like I said, Dad gave away most of your stuff. Maybe somehow that camera ended up with Ellie and Bob, who knows. The Canon PV-1 stands upright with the viewing lens on the top. Bob turns it over and presses the eject button. He reaches back for me to hand him the cassette. I do. He sticks it in and pushes it into the designated slot. It's ready, Bob tells me. Just hit the play button here, he points to it, and you can watch it here. Bob pulls on something, and the little screen hinges out from the side. Everything about this is reminding me of you. Not in a pleasant way. I'll be in the kitchen if you need any help, Bob says. Thanks. Bob heads back into the house, closing the door behind him. No reason for me to drag this out. I hit the play button. It starts with static, which then gives way to darkness. The only thing I can see is the date stamp. 1 week before you and Diana were killed. The picture is shaky, like whoever is holding the camera is walking. It gets shakier, so that maybe whoever was walking is now running. I can't make out anything yet, just black. I think I hear something, but it's faint. I find the volume knob and turn it all the way up. The shaking stops, but the picture is still too dark to make anything out. Playing with the brightness knob doesn't help, so I turn out the lights for better contrast. The garage turns spooky now, the tools more menacing in the shadows. I stare hard at the small screen. Then I hear a voice from the past say, "Is it on, Hank?" My heart stops. The voice on the tape is yours. Hank says, "Yeah, it's on." Then another voice, "Point it up at the sky, Hank." It's Mora. My stopped heart explodes in my chest. I put my hands on the workbench to steady myself. Mora sounds animated. I remember that tone so well. I watch now as the camera pans up. Hank had been pointing the lens at the ground. As he raises it, I can see the lights from the military base. You again, Leo. Do you guys still hear it?
I do. It's faint, though.
That sounds like Rex.
You. Okay, let's stay quiet.
Then I hear Morris say, "Holy shit, look! Just like last week!"
My God, you again. You were right, Mora.
There are lots of overlapping gasps and excited voices now. I try to make them out. You for sure, Mora, Rex, Hank. Another female voice. Diana? Beth? I'll have to back it up later and listen closer. I'm squinting at the screen, hoping to see what has taken them all by surprise. Then I see it too, coming out of the sky, seemingly floating into view. I gasp along with them. It's a helicopter. I try to up the volume so I can hear the rotors, but it's already turned up all the way. As though reading my thoughts, Hank fills me in. Sikorsky Black Hawk, Hank says. Stealth copter. Barely makes a sound. I can't believe it. That sounds like Beth. The screen is tiny, and even with the lights off in Bob's workshop, it is hard to see exactly what is going on. But there is no question about it now. A helicopter is hovering above the old military base. As the copter starts to descend, Mora whispers, "Let's get closer." Rex, "They'll spot us." Mora, "So?" Beth, "I don't know." Mora, "Come on, Hank." The camera grows shaky again as Hank moves, it seems, closer to the base. At one point he stumbles. The camera points to the ground. I see a hand reach out to help him up, and now I can see the white sleeve of my varsity jacket. As the camera comes back up, Hank lands the focus right on Mora's face. My whole body jolts. Her dark hair is a perfectly tangled mess. Her eyes lit with excitement, her killer smile just south of sane. Mora. I actually say this out loud. From the tinny speaker I hear you say, "Shh, stop!" The copter lands. It is hard to see much, but the rotors are still spinning. I can't believe how quiet they are. I'm still not sure what I'm seeing. It may be a door sliding open. There was a flash of bright orange. Could be a person, not sure. Probably has to be. The bright orange reminds me of prisoner garb. There's a noise like someone stepping on a branch. Hank jerks the camera to the right. Rex shouts, "Let's get the hell out of here!" And the picture goes black. I hit the fast-forward button, but that's it. There's nothing else on the tape. I rewind and watch the scene with the helicopter again, then a third time. It never gets easier to hear your voice or see Mora's face. During the fourth viewing, something new occurs to me. I start putting myself into this timeline. Where was I that night? I wasn't part of the conspiracy club. I didn't really think much of it at the time. This clandestine group was somewhere between cute and childish, in my view, between harmless and, when I was unkind, pathetic. You had your games and secrets, I get that. But how could you guys keep something like this secret from me? You used to tell me everything. I try to travel back in time. Where was I that night? It was like the night you died of Friday. Friday was hockey night. Who did we play that night? I don't remember. Did we win? Did I see you when I got home? I don't remember. I know I got together with Mora. We headed into the clearing in those woods. I can still see the tangled hair, the killer smile, the eyes lit with excitement, but something was different that night. Something even more electrifying when we made love. I don't think I wondered why back then. Mora liked the edge, but I probably selfishly chalked it up to my own wonderfulness. That's how wrapped up I, the big jock senior, was in my own stuff. And my twin brother? I think back to that photograph in the attic, the four of us, the stoned, lost look on your face. Something was going on with you, Leo, something big and probably obvious. And because I was a self-involved prick, I missed it, and you died. I unplug the camera. I'm sure that Bob won't mind if I take it with me. But I need to think on it. I don't want to act in haste. Hank hid this video because whatever issues he had, he knew this was big. He was paranoid and probably mentally unwell, and come hell or high water, I still want to honor his wishes. So where do I go with this? Do I take it to the authorities? Do I tell Muse or Manning? Do I tell Augie? First things first, make copies. Put the original in a safe place. I run it through my head, try to see how this all fits together. The old Nike base stayed under government control. It pretended to be some kind of harmless agriculture center so as to hide its real purpose. Okay, I get all that.
I even get that you guys saw something that night that could open the place up to public scrutiny. I might even be able to take it a step further. I might even get why they, and by they, I just mean the bad guys, working at the base, would want to silence you and Diana. Even though I didn't hear Diana on the tape, was she there? I don't know. But either way, the two of you ended up dead. Question. Why would the others still be alive? Possible answer. They didn't know about Rex, Hank, and Beth. They only knew about you and Diana, okay? That makes a modicum of sense. Not much, but I'll take a modicum. And I can add Mora into this equation. Somehow they knew about Mora, too. That's why she ran and hid. On the tape, you and Mora are clearly the leaders, so maybe you two went back and did something careless. You got caught. She ran. It all makes some sense. But again, what about the others? Rex and Hank and Beth continued their lives. None of them hid. Maybe after 15 years they started looking again. Maybe something happened after 15 years, so that suddenly they did know. Like what? No idea. But maybe Augie was onto something when he wondered about Tom Stroud. Maybe I need to figure out when exactly Tom Stroud came back to Westbridge. Enough speculating. I'm still missing something. And there is something else I need to do right now. Confront Ellie. It can't be a coincidence that Mora's mother came to me via Ellie. Ellie knows something. This realization is one I half want to ignore. I've taken enough blows today, thank you very much. But if I can't trust Ellie, if Ellie lied to me and doesn't have my back, then where am I? I take a deep breath and open the workshop door. The first sounds I hear are Leah's and Kelsey's laughter. I realize I'm making this family seem somewhat unreal, a little too perfect, but this is what I see. I once asked Ellie how she and Bob did it, and she said, "We've both been through some wars, so now we fight to preserve this." Maybe I understand, but I'm not sure. Ellie's parents' late-in-life divorce was hard on her. Maybe that's part of it, I don't know. Or maybe we don't know anybody that well. I look for the seams in Ellie and Bob's life. Just because I can't see them doesn't mean they aren't there. And just because Ellie and Bob may hide them doesn't make them any less wonderful or human. Dad's quote, "Every person has hopes and dreams." I head into the kitchen, but Ellie isn't there. There's an open seat. Bob turns to me and says, "Ellie had to run out. She left you a plate." Out the window, I see Ellie heading to her car. I make a quick excuse and sprint after her. She's opening her car door and readying to slide in when I shout, "Do you know where Mora is?" That stops her. Ellie turns toward me. "No." I meet her eyes. "To reach me, her mother came through you." "Yes." "Why you, Ellie?" "I promised her I wouldn't say anything."
"Who?"
"Mora." I know that name is coming, and it still punches me in the teeth. "You," it takes me a second, "you promised Mora?" My mobile rings. It's Augie. I don't answer. Whatever happens now, whatever Ellie tells me, I know nothing will be the same between us anymore. There is very little in my world that keeps me grounded. I have no family. I've let very few people into my world. The person who is dearest to me just pulled the life rug, if you will, out from under me. "I have to go," Ellie says. "There's an emergency at the center." "All these years," I say. "You lied to me."
"No."
"But you never told me."
"I made a promise."
I try to keep the hurt out of my voice. "I thought you were my best friend."
"I am. But being your friend doesn't mean I betray everyone else."
My mobile keeps buzzing. "How could you keep something like this from me?"
"We don't tell each other everything," she says. "What are you talking about? I trust you with my life. But you don't tell me everything, do you, Nap?"
"Of course I do."
"Bullshit!"
Ellie's voice comes out as a surprise whisper scream. One of those things adults do when they're angry but don't want to wake the kids.
"You keep plenty from me."
"What are you talking about?"
Something flashes in her eyes.
You want to tell me about Trey?
I'm about to say who? That's how focused I am on this investigation into the possibility of discovering the truth about that night and feeling betrayed by, of all people, the woman who is closest to me. But then, of course, I remember the baseball bat and the beating. Ellie stares hard at me.
I didn't lie to you, I say. You just didn't tell me.
I say nothing.
You don't think I know it was you who put Trey in the hospital?
It has nothing to do with you, I say.
I'm complicit.
No, you're not. It's on me.
Are you really that dense? There's a line between wrong and right, Knapp. You drag me across it. You break the law.
To punish slime, I say. To help a victim.
Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
Ellie shakes her head, her anger flushing her cheeks.
You don't get it, do you? When the police come around because they figure there might be a connection between an injured man and a battered woman, I have to lie to them. You know that, right? So like it or not, I'm complicit. You involve me, and you don't have the decency to face me with the truth.
I don't say anything to keep you safe. Ellie shakes her head.
Are you sure that's it, Knapp?
What are you talking about?
Maybe you don't tell me because I'd stop you. Maybe you don't tell me because what you do is wrong. I set up that shelter to help the abused, not to go vigilante on the abusers.
It's not on you, I say again. I'm the one who makes that call.
We all make calls.
Her voice is quieter now.
You made the call that Trey deserved a beating. I made the call to keep my word to Maura.
I shake my head as my phone starts up. It's Augie again. You can't keep this from me, Ellie.
Let it go, she says.
What?
You didn't tell me about Trey to protect me.
So?
So maybe I'm doing the same for you.
The phone still rings. I have to take it. As I put it to my ear, Ellie jumps into the car. I'm about to stop her, but then I notice that Bob is standing by the door, watching with a funny look on his face. It'll have to wait.
What?
I shout into the phone.
I finally got hold of Andy Reeves,
Augie tells me. The agriculture commander at the military base. And?
You know the Rusty Nail Tavern?
That's a dive bar in Hackensack, right?
Used to be. Meet him there in an hour.
Chapter 20. I copy the old videotape in the least tech but fastest way possible. I simply play it on the little camera screen while recording it with my smartphone. The quality is not as terrible as I thought it would be, but I won't be winning any cinematography awards either. I upload a copy of the video to my cloud, and then, to be on the safe side, I email it out to another one of my email addresses. Should I send a copy to someone else for safekeeping?
Yes.
The question is who? I consider David Rainiv, but if it ever got traced back, and yes, I'm being paranoid, I don't want to put him in danger. I think about sending it to Ellie, but same issue. Plus, I need to think it through. I need to really consider my next move with her. The obvious answer is Augie, but again, do I want to just send this out to his computer without any kind of warning? I call Augie on the phone.
You at the Rusty Nail yet?
Augie asks. On my way. I'm emailing you a video. I fill him in on David Rainiv's visit and the rest of it. He stays quiet. When I finish, I ask if he's still on the line.
Don't send it to my work, he says.
Okay,
you got my personal email address.
Yes.
Okay, send it there.
There's a longer pause. Then Augie clears his throat and says,
Diana, you said she wasn't on the tape.
I can always hear it when he says Diana's name. I lost you. A brother, a twin. Devastating, sure. But Augie lost his only child. Whenever he says Diana's name, it comes out hoarse, pained, like someone is pummeling him as he speaks. Each syllable rains down new hurt. I didn't see or hear Diana, I tell him, but the tape isn't great quality. You might pick up something I don't.
I still think you're heading up the wrong path.
I think about that. I do too.
So?
So it's the only path I have right now. Might as well stay on it and see where it leads.
Sounds like a plan, though not a good one.
No, not a good one, Augie agrees.
What did you tell Andy Reeves, I ask?
About you?
About my reason for visiting, yeah.
Not a damn thing. What could I tell him? I don't even know.
Part of my plan, I say.
The not good one. Better than none at all, I guess. Now I'm gonna watch the tape. I'll call you if I see anything.
The Rusty Nail is a converted house with cedar shake vinyl siding and a red door. I park between a yellow Ford Mustang with the license plate Ebony Ivory and a bus van hybrid with the words Bergen County Senior Center painted on the side. I don't know what Augie meant by saying it used to be a dive bar. From the outside, it still looks like one to me. The only change I notice is the extensive wheelchair ramp. That didn't used to be there. I head up the steps and open the heavy red door. Initial observation, the crowd is old. Very old. I'm guessing the median age is close to 80. Probably came in from the senior center. Interesting. Seniors take field trips to supermarkets and racetracks and casinos. Why not taverns? The second thing I notice, there is an ostentatious white piano with silver trim like something Liberace would have considered too garish, in the middle of the room, complete with a tip jar, straight out of Billy Joel. I almost expect a real estate novelist and Davy from the Navy to be nursing drinks, but I don't see anyone fitting that description. I see a variety of walkers and canes and wheelchairs. The piano player is pounding out Sweet Caroline. Sweet Caroline has become one of those songs played at every wedding and sporting event, beloved by children and seniors alike. The old patrons sing along enthusiastically. They are off-key and have no pitch and don't care. It's a nice scene. I'm not sure which one is Andy Reeves. In my head, I'm expecting someone in his mid-60s with a crew cut and military bearing. A few of the older men fit the bill, I guess. I step into the room. I spot several strong young guys now, their eyes moving around like wary security guards, and I'm tagging them as bartenders or maybe orderlies for the seniors. The piano player looks up and nods at me. He does not have a crew cut or military bearing. He has feathered blonde hair and that kind of waxy complexion I associate with chemical peels. He beckons with a head gesture for me to take a seat at the piano as the older crowd builds to a giant, ba, 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 good times never seemed so good. So good, so good, so good. I sit. One of the old guys throws his arm around me, nudging me to sing along. I join in for very unenthusiastic, I've been inclined, and wait for someone else, preferably Andy Reeves, to approach me. No one does. I glance around the room. There's a poster featuring four of the happiest, healthiest seniors this side of a Viagra ad with the words, Tuesday afternoon bingo, $3 drinks, emblazoned across their chests. At the bar, a few of the guys I figure are orderlies, bartenders, pour a red beverage into laid-out plastic cups. When Sweet Caroline finishes up, the old folks hoot and holler their approval. I'm almost looking forward to the next song, enjoying this quasi-normalcy, but the feathered-haired piano man stands up and announces a quick break. The old-timers register their disappointment with gusto. 5 minutes, the piano man says. Your drinks are at the bar. Think up a few requests, okay? That placates them a bit. The piano man scoops the money out of what looks like an oversized brandy snifter, heads toward me, and says,
Officer Dumas.
I nod.
I'm Andy Reeves.
First thing I notice, his speaking voice is a little breathy. Or whispery. He takes the seat next to me. I try to guess the age. Even with whatever weird cosmetic work has made his face shiny, he can't be more than mid-50s. But then again, the military base only closed down 15 years ago. Why does he have to be older than that? I glance around. This place, I say.
What about it?
It seems a far distance from the Department of Agriculture.
I know, right? He spreads his hands. What can I say? I needed a change.
So you no longer work for the government?
I retired, what, 7 years ago?
Worked for the USDA for 25 years. Got a nice pension, and now I'm pursuing my passion.
Piano?
Yes. I mean, not here. This is, well, you have to start somewhere, right?
I study his face. The tan is from a bottle or bed, not the sun.
I can see some very pale skin near the hairline.
Right, I say.
We had a piano at that old Westbridge office. I used to play there all the time. Helped us relax when the job got too stressful.
Reeves shifts in his seat and flashes teeth so big and dazzlingly white that they could double as piano keys.
So what can I do for you, detective?
I jump right in. What kind of work were you guys doing at the military base?
Military base?
That's what it used to be, I say. A control center for Nike missiles.
Oh, I know.
He shakes his head in awe.
What a history that place has, am I right?
I say nothing.
But all of that, well, it was years before we moved in. We were just an office complex, not a military base.
An office complex for the USDA, I say.
That's right. Our mission was to provide leadership on food, agriculture, natural resources, rural development, nutrition, and related issues based on sound public policy, the best available science, and efficient management.
It sounds rehearsed, probably, because it is.
Why there, I ask. Pardon?
The USDA has an office on Independence Avenue in Washington, D.C.
Headquarters, sure. We were a satellite.
But why there, in the woods like that?
Why not?
He says, lifting his palms to the ceiling.
It was a great space. Some of the work we did, well, I don't want to boast or make it sound more glamorous than it was, but many of our studies were absolutely top secret.
He leans forward.
Did you ever see the movie Trading Places?
Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, Jamie Lee Curtis, I say. He's very pleased that I know it.
That's the one. If you remember, the Duke brothers were trying to corner the orange juice market, right?
Right.
Do you remember how?
Reeves smiles as he sees on my face that I do.
The Dukes were bribing a government official to obtain an advance copy of the USDA's monthly crop report. The USDA, Detective Dumas.
That was us.
Many of our studies were that important. We needed privacy and tight security.
I nod. So that's why you had the fence and all the no trespassing signs?
Exactly.
Reeves spreads his hands again.
Where better for us to conduct our testing than a former military base?
Anybody ever defy those signs?
For the first time, I think I see the smile flicker. What do you mean?
Did you ever have trespassers?
Sometimes, Reeves says, as casually as he can muster. Kids would sneak into the woods to drink or smoke pot.
And then what?
What do you mean?
Would the kids ignore the warning signs?
Something like that.
What would they do then?
Nothing. They'd just walk past the signs.
And what would you do about that?
Nothing.
Nothing?
We might tell them that this was private property.
Might, I ask. Or did?
Sometimes we did, I guess.
How would you do that exactly?
Pardon?
Walk me through it. A kid goes past your sign. What would you do?
Why are you asking?
I put a little snap in my voice. Just answer the question, please.
We'd tell him to go back. We'd remind him that he was trespassing.
Who would remind him, I ask?
I don't understand.
Would you be the one to remind him?
No, of course not.
Then who?
One of our security guards.
Were they guarding the woods?
What?
The signs started probably 50 yards away from your fence.
Andy Reeves considers this. No, the guards wouldn't be that far out. They would be more interested in controlling the perimeter.
So you probably wouldn't see a trespasser until he reached your fence, is that correct?
I don't see the relevance.
How would you spot this trespassing kid? I ask, changing gears. Would you rely on the guards' vision, or did you have cameras?
I think we may have had a few.
Think you had cameras you don't remember? I'm testing his patience. That's not unintentional. Reeves starts tapping the top of the table with a fingernail. A long fingernail, I notice.
Then he gives me the toothy grin and whispers again, I'm really not going to take much more badgering, detective.
Yeah, okay, sorry, I say. I tilt my head.
So let me ask you this. Why would stealth Blackhawks be landing at a USDA, I do finger quotes, office complex at night?
Drop the mic, as one of my goddaughters might say.
Andy Reeves hadn't been expecting that one. His mouth drops open, though not for long. His eyes harden. The big wide smile has been replaced with something close-mouthed and far more reptilian.
I have no idea what you're talking about, he whispers.
I try to stare him down, but he has no problem with too much eye contact. I don't like that. We all think eye contact is great or a sign of honesty, but like most things, too much indicates an issue.
It's been 15 years, Reeves. He doesn't stop staring. I don't care what you guys were doing. I try to keep the pleading out of my voice. I just need to know what happened to my brother.
Exact same volume. Exact same cadence. Exact same words.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
My brother's name was Leo Dumas. He pretends to be thinking about it, trying to dredge up the name from his memory bank. He was hit by a train with a girl named Diana Stiles.
Oh, Augie's daughter.
Andy Reeves shakes his head the way people do when they speak of someone else's tragedy.
Your brother was the young man killed with her?
He knows this. I know this. He knows I know.
I'm sorry for your loss.
The condescension drips off his voice like maple syrup off a stack of pancakes. Intentionally, of course. Striking back at me. I already told you I don't care what you were doing at the base, I try. So if you want me to stop digging into this, all you have to do is tell me the truth. Unless.
Unless what?
Unless you killed my brother, I say. Reeves doesn't take the bait. Instead, he makes a scene out of checking his watch. He looks over at the old folks, starting to meander back toward the piano.
My break is over.
He stands. Before you go, I say. I take out my phone. The video is already up. It's cued to the first time the helicopter appears. I click the play button and hold it up for him. Even the fake tan is leaving his face now.
I don't know what that's supposed to be, he says,
but his voice just isn't making it. Sure you do. It's a Sikorsky Blackhawk stealth helicopter flying over what you claim is a Department of Agriculture office complex. If you watch a few more moments, that helicopter will land, and after that, you'll be able to see a man in a prisoner-issue orange jumpsuit get out of that copter. That's a touch of an exaggeration. You really just see an orange dot, but a touch is all you need.
You can't verify.
Sure I can. There is a date stamp. The buildings and landscape are unique enough. I have the volume turned down, but the whole thing is narrated. Another exaggeration. The teenagers who made the tape spell out exactly where they are and what they are witnessing. His glare is back. One more thing, I say.
What?
You can hear three teenage boys on the tape. All three have died under mysterious circumstances. One of the old men shouts out,
Hey, Andy! Can I request Living on a Prayer?
I hate Madonna,
another says.
That's like a prayer, you moron! Living on a Prayer is Bon Jovi! Who you calling a moron?
Andy Reeves ignores them. He turns to me. The facade is gone now. The whisper is harsher.
Is that the only copy of the tape?
Yes, I say, giving him flat eyes. I was dumb enough to come here without making copies. He speaks through gritted teeth.
If that tape is what you claim, and I stress the word if, revealing it would be a federal offense punishable by a prison sentence.
Andy.
What?
Do I look scared?
It would be treason to reveal that.
I point to my calm face, indicating again that I do not in any way, shape, or form appear frightened by this threat.
If you dare show it to anyone.
Let me stop you there, Andy. I don't want you to worry your pretty head about it. If you don't tell me what I want to know, I'll definitely show it. I'll post it all over Twitter and Facebook with your name on it. I pretend to have a pen and paper and prepare to mime writing. Is Reeves spelled with two E's or E-A?
I had nothing to do with your brother.
How about my girlfriend, then? Her name is Maura Wells. You want to tell me you had nothing to do with her, either?
My God.
Andy Reeves slowly shakes his head.
You have no clue, do you?
I don't like the way he says it, with sudden confidence. I don't know how to reply, so I go with a simple, so tell me. Another patron shouts,
Play Don't Stop Believin', Andy! We love that one! Sinatra! Journey!
Murmurs of agreement. One guy starts singing,
Just a small town girl!
The other answers,
Living in a lonely world!
One second, fellas.
Reeves waves and smiles. Just a good old guy enjoying the attention.
Save your energy.
Andy Reeves turns back to me, lowers his mouth until it's close to my ear, and whispers,
If you release that tape, Detective Dumas, I'll kill you and everyone you love. Do I make myself clear?
Crystal. I nod. Then I reach out, grab him by the balls, and squeeze. His scream shatters the night air. A few of the old folks jump up, startled. When I let go, Reeves flops to the floor like a fish hitting a dock. The younger guys, the orderlies, react. They rush toward me. I back up, take out my shield. Stay where you are, I warn. Police business. The old folks don't like this. Neither do three of the orderlies. They come closer, circling me. I take out my phone and snap a quick pic. The old-timers yell at me.
What do you think you're doing? If I was 10 years younger, you can't just do that. Leave it out of prayer!
One drops to his knee to tend to the wounded Reeves as the orderlies move closer. I need to close this down now. I show the approaching orderlies the gun in my hip holster. I don't pull it out, but the sight is enough to slow them down. An old man shakes his fist at me.
We're going to report you.
Do what you must, I say.
You better get out of here now.
I agree. 5 seconds later, I'm out the door. Chapter 21. I'm not worried about my behavior being called into law enforcement. Andy Reeves will recover, and when he does, he won't want anyone reporting the incident. I am more worried, however, about Reeves' threat. 4 people, you, Diana, Rex, and Hank, have been murdered. Yes? I'm going to use that term now. Forget the claims of accident and suicide. You were murdered, Leo. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let that go. I call Ellie. She doesn't answer, which pisses me off. I look on my phone and check the photo I took of Reeves. He's on the floor, his face scrunched up in pain, but it's clear enough. I attach it to a text and send it to Ellie. The text reads, See if Maura's mom recognizes him. I start to drive home, but I realize that I haven't eaten anything. I veer to the right and make my way to the Armstrong Diner. It's open 24 hours. Through the window, I see that Bunny is on duty. As I get out of the car, my phone rings. It's Ellie.
Hey,
she says. Hey. That's our way of realizing we went too far, I guess.
Where are you? She asks.
The Armstrong.
I'll be there in half an hour.
The phone goes dead. I get out and start toward the diner. 2 girls, probably late teens, maybe early 20s, stand outside smoking and jabbering away. One is blonde, one brunette. Both resembling internet models or wannabe reality stars. That's the look, I guess. I walk past them as they take deep drags. Then I stop and turn back toward them. I stare at them until they feel my eyes. They keep talking for a second or two, glancing toward me. I don't move. Eventually their voices fade away. The blonde makes a face at me.
What's your problem?
I should just go inside, I say. I should just mind my own business, but I want to say one thing first. They both look at me the way you do at a crazy person. Please don't smoke, I say. The brunette puts her hands on her hips.
Do we know you?
No, I say.
You a cop or something?
I am, but that has nothing to do with it. My father died of lung cancer because he smoked. So I can just walk right past you. Or I can try to save your life. Chances are you won't listen to me, but maybe if I do this enough, maybe just one time, someone will stop and think, and maybe even quit. So I'm asking you, I'm sort of begging you, please don't smoke.
That's it. I head inside. Stavros is behind the cash register. He gives me a high five and nods toward a table in the corner. I'm a single guy who doesn't like to cook, so I'm here a lot for dinner. Like the menus at most New Jersey diners, the Armstrong's menu is Bible length. Bunny just gives me the specials menu. She points to the salmon with couscous and gives me a wink. I look out the window. The two smoking girls are still outside. The brunette has her back to me, the cigarette between her fingers. The blonde gives me a baleful look, but there is no cigarette in her hand. I give her a thumbs up. She turns away. She probably finished it already, but I take the victories where I can. I'm just about finished with my meal when Ellie comes through the door. Stavros's face lights up when he sees her. It's a cliché to say that someone lights up a room when she enters it, but at the very least, Ellie raises the average level of goodness, of decency, of virtue in it. This is the first time I just don't take all that for granted. She slides in across the booth, tucking one foot under her. "Did you get that photograph to Maura's mom?" I ask. Ellie nods. She hasn't replied yet. I see her blink away tears. "Ellie, something else I never told you."
"What?"
"2 years ago, when I spent that month in Washington."
I nod, for that conference on the homeless.
She makes a, "Yeah, right," noise. "A conference." She picks up the napkin and starts dabbing at her eyes. "That lasts a month?"
I don't know what to make of that, so I stay silent.
"This has nothing to do with Maura, by the way. I reach out and put my hand on her arm. "What is it?" "You're the best person I know, Nap. I trust you with my life. But I didn't tell you."
"Didn't tell me what?"
"Bob..."
I stay perfectly still.
"There was this woman at work. Bob started staying late, so one night I surprised him. The two of them..."
I feel my heart bottom out. I don't know what to say, and I don't think she wants me to say anything, so I tighten the grip on her arm a little. I want to offer some kind of comfort, but I blew that chance. A month-long conference. Man. My best friend was in horrible pain, and I never saw it. Some great detective, right? Ellie wipes her eyes and forces up a smile.
"It's better now. Bob and I cleared the air."
"You want to talk about it?"
"Not right now, no. I came to talk to you about Maura, about my promise to her."
Bunny comes over, drops a menu in front of Ellie, gives her a wink. When she leaves, I don't know how to continue. Neither does Ellie. So finally I say, "You made a promise to Maura."
"Yes."
"When?"
"The night Leo and Diana died."
Another punch in the teeth. Bunny comes back over and asks Ellie if she wants to order anything. Ellie says a decaf. I manage to order a mint tea. Bunny asks whether either of us wants to try the banana pudding it's to die for. We both decline.
"That night," I say, "did you see Maura before or after Leo and Diana died?" Her answer sends me into another tailspin. "Both."
I don't know what to say. Or maybe I'm afraid of what I might say. She looks out the window into the parking lot. "Ellie?"
"I'll break my promise to Maura," she says. "But Nap..."
"What?"
"You're not going to like it."
"Let me start with the after," Ellie says. The diner is emptying out, but we don't care. Bunny and Stavros have been steering newcomers to the opposite end of the diner, giving us privacy.
"Maura came to my house," she says. I wait for Ellie to say more. She doesn't.
"That night?"
"Yes."
"What time?"
"About 3 in the morning. My parents had broken up, and Dad, he wanted me happy, so he converted the garage into a bedroom for me, which was pretty awesome for a teenager. My friends could come at all hours because you could reach my room without waking anybody."
I'd heard rumors about Ellie's back door always being open, but this was before Ellie and I became tight, before my brother and Ellie's best friend Diana were found on those railroad tracks. I wonder about that now. The two sturdiest relationships in my adult life are with Ellie and Augie, both born from that tragic night. So anyway, when I first heard the knock, I didn't think much of it. People knew that if they couldn't go home yet, if they were too drunk or whatever, they could crash at my place.
Had Maura ever come by before, I ask?
No, never. I know I've told you this, but I was always a little in awe of Maura. She just seemed, I don't know, cooler than the rest of us. More mature and worldly. You know what I mean?
I nod. So why did she come to you?
I asked her that, but at first, Maura was just a wreck, crying and hysterical. Which, like I said, was weird to me because she always seemed above it all. It took me like 5 minutes to calm her down. She was covered in dirt. I thought she'd been attacked or something. I actually started checking her clothes to see if anything had been ripped. I read about that in some rape trauma class. Anyway, when she started to calm down, it almost happened too quickly. I don't know how else to put it. Like, someone had slapped her in the face and shouted, "Snap out of it."
What did you do?
I broke out a bottle of Fireball whiskey I had hidden under my bed.
You?
She shakes her head. You really think you know everything about me, don't you?
Evidently not, I think.
Anyway, Maura shook me off, said she needed to keep a clear head. She asked if she could stay with me for a while. I said, of course. Truthfully, I was kind of flattered that she chose me.
This is 3 in the morning.
Around 3, yeah.
So you didn't know about Leo and Diana yet, I say.
Right.
Did Maura tell you?
No. She just said she needed a place to hide. Ellie leaned forward. Then she looked me dead in the eyes and made me promise. You know how intense she could be, right? She made me promise not to tell anyone she was here. Not ever. Not even you.
She specifically said me? Ellie nods.
I actually thought at first maybe you two had a big fight, but she was too scared. She came to me, I think, because, well, I'm reliable Ellie, right? There were people closer to her. That's what I kept wondering about. Why me? Now I know.
Know what?
Why she came to me. You heard her, Mom. People were looking for her. I didn't know that back then, but Maura must have figured anyone close to her would be watched or questioned.
I nod. So she couldn't go home.
Right. She probably thought that they'd spy on you or question your dad. If they wanted to find her, they'd search the people close to her.
I see it now.
And you really weren't a friend.
Exactly.
She figured that they wouldn't go to me.
So what were they after? Why were these people looking for her?
I don't know.
You didn't ask?
I asked. She didn't tell me.
And you let that go. Ellie almost smiles.
You don't remember how persuasive Maura could be?
Oh, I do. I get it.
I learned later that Maura told me nothing for the same reason she told her mother nothing.
To protect you?
Yes.
If you didn't know anything, I continue, you couldn't tell them anything.
She also made me promise Snap. She made me swear that until she came back on her own, I couldn't tell anyone. I tried to keep that promise, Snap. I know you're angry about it. But something about the way Maura said it, I wanted to keep my word. And I was really afraid that breaking my word would lead to disaster. To tell you the truth, even now, even as we sit here, I think it's the wrong thing. I didn't want to tell you.
So what changed your mind?
Too many people are dying, Nap. And I wonder whether Maura is one of them.
You think she's dead?
Her mom and I... We naturally bonded after this. That first call at the Bennigans, I helped set that up. Lynn left that part out when she talked to you, to protect me.
I don't know what to say to all this. You lied to me all these years.
You were obsessed.
Again, that word. Ellie says, I am obsessed. David Rainiv says Hank was obsessed.
If I told you about this promise, Ellie says, well, I had no idea how you'd react.
Wasn't your place to worry about my reaction.
Maybe not. But it wasn't my place to break a promise either.
I still don't get it. How long did Maura stay with you?
2 nights. And then? Ellie shrugs. I came home and she was gone.
No note, no nothing?
Nothing.
And since then?
More nothing.
I haven't seen her or heard from her since.
Something isn't adding up. Wait. When did you learn about Leo's and Diana's deaths?
I heard about it the day after they were found. I called Diana's house and asked for her, and...
I see her eyes water up again.
Her mom. God, her voice.
Audrey Stiles told you over the phone.
No. She asked me to come over. I could hear it. I ran the whole way. She sat me down in the kitchen when she finished. I went home to ask Maura, but she was gone. Still not adding up. But, I mean, you had to figure it was connected, right?
She didn't reply.
Maura comes to you the night Leo and Diana die, I say. You had to think there was some link.
Ellie nods slowly. I figured it couldn't be a coincidence. That's right.
And yet you didn't tell anyone.
I made a promise, Nap.
Your best friend had just been killed, I say. How could you not tell anyone?
Ellie lowers her head. I stop for a second. You were the most responsible girl in the school, I say.
I could see you keeping a promise. That makes sense, but once you found out Diana was dead...
We all thought it was an accident, remember? Or maybe a weird double suicide, though I never believed that. But I didn't think Maura had anything to do with it.
Come on, Ellie, you can't be that naive.
How could you not tell someone?
She lowers her head again. I know it now. She's hiding something.
Ellie.
I did tell someone.
Who?
But that was part of Maura's genius when I look back at it. What could I tell anyone? I had no idea where she was.
Who did you tell?
Diana's parents.
I freeze. You told Augie and Audrey?
Yes.
Augie.
I think I can't be stunned anew, yet here I am. He knew that Maura had stayed at your house?
She nods, and I'm reeling again.
Can you trust anyone in this world, Leo?
Ellie lied to me. Augie lied to me. Who else? Mom, of course.
When she said she was coming right back. Did Dad lie too? Did you?
What did Augie say to you, I ask?
He thanked me. And he told me to keep my promise.
I need to see Augie. I need to go over to his house and figure out what the hell is going on here. But then I remember something else Ellie told me. You said before and after.
What?
I asked you if you saw Maura before or after Leo and Diana died. You said both.
Ellie nods.
You told me about the after.
What about the before? She looks off.
What is it, I ask.
This is the part, Ellie says, you're not going to like.
Chapter 22. She stands across the street from the Armstrong Diner and watches them through the window. 15 years ago, after the gunfire shattered the still night, she ran and hid for 2 hours. When she ventured out and saw the parked cars with the men in them, she knew for sure. She made her way toward the bus stop. It didn't matter which bus she got on, she just wanted distance. All the buses leaving Westbridge ended up in either Newark or New York City. From there, she could find friends and support. But it was late. Very few buses were still operating at that hour. Even worse, when she started up near the station by Karim Square, she again noticed men nearby in parked cars. For the next 2 nights, she stayed with Ellie. The 3 days after that, she hid in the Livingston basement art studio of Hugh Warner, her art teacher. Mr. Warner was single, wore a ponytail, and always smelled like a bong. Then she started moving. Mr. Warner had a friend in Alphabet City. She stayed there for 2 days. She cut her hair and dyed it blonde. For a few weeks, she followed groups of foreign tourists in Central Park and stole cash, but when she nearly got caught by an off-duty cop from Connecticut, she knew that had to end. A panhandler told her about a guy in Brooklyn who did fake IDs. She bought 4 new names. The IDs weren't perfect, but they were good enough to get her temporary employment. For the next 3 years, she moved around, a lot. In Cincinnati, she waitressed at a luncheonette. In Birmingham, she worked the cash register at Piggly Wiggly. In Daytona Beach, she donned a bikini and sold timeshares, which felt grimier than robbing the tourists. She slept on streets, in public parks, in chain motels, they were always clean, in the homes of strange men. She knew that if she just kept moving, she would be safe. They couldn't put out an APB on her. There were no wanted posters. They were looking, but they were limited. The public couldn't help them. She joined various religious groups, feigning a reverence for whatever egomaniac served as minister, and used that to find housing, nourishment, protection. She danced at remote gentlemen's clubs, the strangest of euphemisms because they are neither, where the money was good, but the attention too great. She was robbed twice, beaten, and one night she got in way over her head. She blocked on that and moved on. She started carrying a knife. In a parking lot outside of Denver, two men attacked her. She stabbed one deep in the gut. Blood poured from his mouth. She ran. He may have died. She never knew. She sometimes hung around community colleges, where the security wasn't too tight, and even attended classes. Near Milwaukee, she tried to settle down for a bit, even getting her real estate license. But an attorney noticed something wrong with her ID during a closing. In Dallas, she prepared taxes at a storefront accounting chain. They pretend to hire real accountants, but her training was a 3-week seminar at the Courtyard Marriott, and for the first time, perhaps because the loneliness was getting overwhelming, she made a real friend in a co-worker named Anne Hannon. Anne was great fun and warm, and they became roommates. They double-dated and went to movies, and even took a vacation together to San Antonio. Anne Hannon was the first person she trusted enough to tell the truth, but of course, for both their protection, she never did. One day, as she approached the storefront, she noticed two men in suits sitting in the waiting area reading newspapers. There were often people in the waiting area, but these guys looked wrong. She could see Anne through the window. Her always smiling friend was not smiling. So she ran again, just like that. Never called Anne to say goodbye. That summer she worked in a cannery in Alaska. She then did a 3-month stint selling excursions on a cruise ship running from Skagway to Seattle. There were a few kind men along the way, but most were not kind. Most were anything but kind. As the years passed, she twice ran into people who recognized her as Maura Wells, one in Los Angeles, one in Indianapolis. That was bound to happen when she looked back on it now. You spend your life on streets or in public places, someone is going to see you. It was no big deal. She didn't pretend that they were mistaken or claim that she was someone else. She had stories ready, usually involving doing a graduate program. As soon as the person was out of sight, she would be gone. She always had a backup plan, always knew where the nearest truck stop was, because that was the easiest way to get a ride when you looked like she did. A guy was bound to give her a lift. Sometimes, if she got to the stop early enough, she would watch them eat and converse and interact, trying to decide which driver looked the least predatory. You could tell, or you could be wrong. She didn't ask the women drivers for lifts, even the seemingly friendly ones, because women on the road had learned to be suspicious, and she was afraid that they might call her in. She had a series of wigs now, and various glasses with no prescription. That was enough of a disguise in the event that anyone said anything. There are various theories about why the years seem to pass faster as you get older. The most popular is also the most obvious. As you get older, each year is a smaller percentage of your life. If you are 10 years old, a year is 10%. If you're 50 years old, a year is 2%. But she had read a theory that spurned that explanation. The theory states that time passes faster when we are in a set routine, when we aren't learning anything new, when we stay stuck in a life pattern. The key to making time slow down is to have new experiences. You may joke that the week you went on vacation flew by far too quickly, but if you stop and think about it, that week actually seemed to last much longer than one involving the drudgery of your day job. You are complaining about it going away so fast because you loved it, not because it felt as though time was passing faster. If you want to slow down time, this theory holds. If you want to make the days last,
do something different. Travel to exotic locales. Take a class. In a sense,